Running a business keeps you on your toes. Wouldn't it be great if your internet connection could keep up? Introducing Business Class Fiber from Vox. It's super fast, reliable, and highly cost-effective. You get unlimited calls to all SA destinations, and it's scalable. So no matter the size of your business, you've still got room to grow. Get connected with Business Class Fiber from Vox and see what super fast internet really means. For more information, visit vox.co.za.
My name is Duncan MacLeod. Thank you for downloading the Tech Central podcast. I'm very excited about the interview we're doing here this morning. I'm here with MTN Group Interim Executive Chairman, soon to be non-executive chairman, Patuma Nhleko. Patuma, welcome to the podcast.
No, thank you very much, Duncan. It's really an honor to be on your program.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's great to have you here. I know that you don't give a lot of in-depth media interviews, so I'm grateful for your time today to talk in general about MTN, your time at the company, and also hopefully we'll have time to talk about the industry more broadly and some of the exciting things that are happening. But I'd like to, given the fact that this is your last day, Friday the 10th of March, as Interim Executive Chairman, you'll be making way for Rob Shooter, who starts as the new group CEO on Monday. I don't think you ever really expected to come back in an interim executive capacity at MTN, did you? It was the crisis of 2015 that really propelled you back into this position.
Yes, I think it was totally unforeseen, and I certainly don't think it was the most prudent thing to have done, but nonetheless, the circumstances dictated that we had to act quickly, and it's I guess all history now.
Sure. So I want to talk a bit about what happened in 2015 and what's happened at this group over the last 18 months, because a heck of a lot has actually happened under your leadership over this period. But I want to go back and talk a bit about your history at the MTN Group. You first became Group CEO back in 2002. Is that right?
Yes, I had a somewhat unusual trajectory in this group, because I actually started off as chairman in 2001, and at that stage Paul Edwards was the CEO.
That's right.
And then I was asked to, when he left, I was asked to become the CEO. So I became, chairman, then CEO, and then as it happens, chairman again in 2012. Yeah.
Right. Okay. And you led MTN through its biggest growth phase through the 2000s. You led some big acquisitions, which I think at the time weren't universally welcomed by some analysts. I think there was some criticism around the price you paid. I think that criticism probably died away quite quickly after those deals were bedded down. But let's look back at that period. You were CEO between 2002 and 2011. You then stepped down completely from the group. I think you weren't on the board at all for a while, and then you came back as non-exec chairman.
Yes, that's correct. I stepped down in 2011, was basically away for 2.5 years, almost 3 years, and then of course the deputy president. Current deputy president was at that stage chairman of MTN, a non-executive. So when he went into politics, the board approached me and said, would I be willing to come back as non-executive chairman? And quite a contested decision in my own head, but in the end I thought, being almost 3 years out of the business, there was no harm in coming back. And which I did, so that's really what transpired there.
Okay, so looking back on your years at MTN, which cumulatively must be running to at least 15, if I'm working that out correctly, what would you describe as your highlights? What would you, if you had to choose a single thing as your greatest achievement as leader of the MTN Group, what would it be?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it can be a very long discussion, but if I had to try and crystallize it, in 2001, 2002, MTN was really in a few countries, South Africa, Swaziland, Rwanda, and I think Uganda. We then, in a very calculated manner, decided to take a long-term view as to where this company needed to be 5 years from there. And in fact, I can bring it right down to a strategy session we had in Livingston, in Zambia, mm-hmm. where we realized that if we didn't start stretching ourselves outside South Africa, we were unlikely to maintain the growth in earnings that we had at the time. We forged that strategy and we followed it to the T. Shortly after we forged that, the Saudi Arabia license came on the table, the Iranian license came on the table, and we decided to pursue that. And then, of course, subsequent to that, after securing Iran but not securing Saudi Arabia, we tried to merge acquire Celtel. And the deal was 95% done until one weekend just before we signed. The Kuwaitis came with an extra $600 million, and that's how we lost that deal, which was most unfortunate. Nonetheless, I think a year later, we then acquired Investcom from the Mikati family. So if you look at all those steps, including, of course, going into Nigeria around 2000-2001, we essentially, as a team, took what was essentially a very domestic-centric company coming out of the 1994 dispensation and really turned it into a significant emerging market player, which today has, over 240 million subscribers stretching from South Africa to West Africa to East Africa and really eastwards all the way to Afghanistan and Syria. And so, I think the team that worked on that, has got quite a lot to be proud of. Not to say we didn't have challenges, but I think certainly, there was a lot that was accomplished there. The big issue now is what is the paradigm shift, which is patently obvious, that has to be taken, and how do we now, edge the next 10 years? And hopefully the new team will do quite a lot of work in that respect.
Well, I want to get your views a bit later in this podcast on the shifts that are taking place in this industry, and they're quite fundamental. But back in those days when you're looking at those acquisitions, when MTN was going into Nigeria, it wasn't clear that those were necessarily going to be the successes that they turned out to be, particularly Nigeria. I think there was a lot of skepticism at the time about the MTN group going into Nigeria. It was an unknown market. There was a perception of a great deal of risk in that market. I think the same could be said about the Iranian market, especially in light of the sanctions that have been applied, etc. Mm-hmm. Given what's transpired more recently, particularly in the Nigerian context, just your thoughts on going into these so-called frontier markets, did you ever have any worries about going after what many analysts saw as risky opportunities? Did you have sleepless nights about going into some of these places?
Well, I would say that the answer would have to be yes. You are a little bit anxious because there are so many unknowns in those markets. But I think quite a lot of people need to take credit for the Nigeria investment, including people like Irene Chanley and Rob Nisbet and so on. The issue really was fundamentally the fact that one in every five Africans is actually Nigerian. So the size of the market is of such a scale that if you profess to have any Pan-African strategy, not to be in Nigeria just wouldn't make any sense. Mm. I think as far as the more far afield geographies are concerned, like the Irans of the world, that evolved, as I said, off our strat session, I think it was in 2003, where we just said, well, we must be ambitious. And, you know, once again, I don't think that there was a shortage of prophets of doom on why this wouldn't work. But I am happy to say that notwithstanding us recognizing some of the risks, we again recognize that Saudi Arabia and Iran are absolutely the key markets in the Middle East. It's unfortunate we secured one and not the other, and I think we lost it by $300 million on the bid. But nonetheless, I mean, Iran's got, you know, 80, 90 million people, you know, very educated middle class, very young demographics, and we felt that we had to be there. But there were risks. One of those, of course, being geopolitical in the sense that there were sanctions, but I should state clearly, because there's a huge amount of misconception here, at that stage, it was not really United Nations sanctions when we went in. It was really just, you know, sanctions that the U.S. had unilaterally imposed after the 1979 revolution. Once we got in, you know, unfortunately, things then did deteriorate at that stage, because then you got, you know, global sanctions and so on. I'm happy once again to say we weathered the storm. And as you saw from the results, we did repatriate almost 900 million euro, so almost €1 billion, which is the money that we put in, plus the dividends for 5 years. There's probably, you know, out of that initial amount, another $270 million that's still to come out. Sorry, 270 million euros, excuse me. And most importantly, we've set a channel now where, you know, all things being equal and, you know, save for some totally unforeseen revision of the U.S. position, we'd expect, you know, that business to continue thriving. And so on. So yes, we'd like to believe we read it correctly, but we have had bumps along the way, which is not totally unexpected.
Sure, I want to come back and talk about some of those bumps, particularly what happened in Nigeria in 2015. But I've asked you what your, if you like, what your the moment you're most proud of it in your legacy at MTN. But there must be things you regret as well. With the benefit of hindsight, what would you do differently?
Well, if I had to look at it, I would say that probably the two largest regrets, which would have been exceptionally transformational, would have been if we had concluded the Celtel transaction as we had intended. I think it was far more cost effective from a pricing perspective. And would have, of course, given us a stronger consolidating footprint. I think that's one big regret, which would have had, you know, an even stronger material impact on the company than what we've had. The second one, regret-wise, I have no doubt that if we had bid just $300 million more in Saudi Arabia, if I look at what has happened in that market, would have done, you know, exceptionally well. And I think the whole fine matter, of course, is regretful, but, you know, I wasn't really playing an executive role at that stage. The Bharti transaction, some days it's a regret and some days it's actually a joyous outcome that it didn't happen. So it really, really just depends. And I think the jury is still out on that one, depending on what happens in the India market. But by and large, you know, what would have happened is that it would have reduced our concentration in Nigeria, as an example, and therefore make the company far less susceptible to the impact of tremors that often come from there. On the other hand, the Indian market has turned out to be exceptionally difficult. Mm-hmm. You also have to factor in currencies, which is another, you know, aspect that you'd have to look at. So I'd say those three things really One wishes that, you know, they would have happened, and would have happened, you know, quite differently.
Mm. Let's just talk about. You mentioned Nigeria. Let's spend a couple of minutes talking about what happened there. Do you think it was a self-inflicted wound? Do you think it was avoidable? What's your take on what happened there? Or do you think the Nigerian authorities were unfair to you?
Yes, I. Duncan, I'd say that the problem with those kind of matters is that, of course, in the press they get covered in sound bites, and headline bites, when in fact the reality is considerably far more complicated. Just to highlight it in short, could MTN Nigeria have acted differently? The answer is absolutely yes. I think that we could have, at the time, have been far more responsive in engaging the regulators. There's no doubt about that. On the other hand, the best way of explaining this in the South African context is that effectively we were being asked to be a mobile operator plus the Department of Home Affairs because in South Africa, you've got your national ID, you just go into CNA and say, I want a MTN SIM card, and that ID, that chip or whatever it is, has got absolutely everything, or barcode. There isn't a national ID in Nigeria. Therefore, by and large, a lot of these people, millions of them, I mean, we had 65 million customers, were being captured for the first time. In any coherent way. And the standards that were expected of us were very, very, very high standards, almost, you know, FBI kind of standards. So the wherewithal of putting that infrastructure was incredibly, incredibly difficult. And we fell short. But as I said in the last few minutes, we could have engaged to try and preempt the situation. Third and lastly, the process that was followed to actually impose the fine is not without voids. And we could have continued for quite an extended period with the legal action that we had begun because we thought that, you know, whether you want to call it a degree of unfairness, but I'm just saying it wasn't a simple question of, you know, you're wrong, you're right. Mm. But we all know that in any country, in a regulated environment, it's not prudent to get into a contested, long battle with government. I think in the end, you just don't make the environment work for you. So we then reluctantly decided to settle. And move on. But it was, as you know, a pretty extended negotiation with many, many difficult twists and turns. But we ended up at, 30% or around 33% of the face value of the initial fine. So it's hard to say that's a positive, but I think it is a positive given what it could have done to this group.
You brought Eric Holder in, the former U.S. Attorney General, who no doubt, whose services no doubt are not cheap.
Yeah.
What role did he play in the negotiation?
Yeah. Eric was very, very useful because, as you know, regardless of the merits or demerits of the fine, if you assume that the fine is legitimate and it's imposed, you then need to say what is the global practice in terms of how those fines need to be dealt with. The irony of the situation is that for almost 6 years, I was actually on the BP PLC board, and at that stage, Eric Holder was the Attorney General in the U.S. who applied the biggest fine in U.S. history. So.
Was that the Deepwater Horizon?
The Deepwater Horizon, yeah. And as life would have it, then of course he went into the into private practice, and I think probably he was one of the authorities in the world on, you know, huge fines that have been imposed. So we thought that, you know, other than his, you know, experience in the firm, you know, that was helping us, we did think that he could help bring a perspective on what is realistic in terms of proportionality. So I think in that respect, absolutely, I think he was very useful. And of course, at that stage, when we started off, the tensions were exceedingly high, and it was very important to start off with a bridge-building exercise, which I think he did assist with.
Great. I want to move on a bit. You mentioned at the beginning of this interview that the industry is at a turning point, if you like. It's you know, it's been dominated for two decades by voice services. The industry's done very well out of voice historically.
Yes.
We're moving into a data-driven world. Operators are talking about getting into MTN among them, getting into digital services, and you're making a number of big investments in that area. You talk to some analysts and they say that you know, the good days are over for the mobile industry, that they're never going to see the sort of margins they saw in the past with the voice services, and that in effect, actually, mobile operators are going to become dumb pipes like fixed line operators are. What's your view on this whole debate, and where do you think the industry is going?
Well, I take a somewhat contrarian view on that. I believe that, you know, good companies are the ones that ride the wave and do exceptionally well, and that great companies are the ones, you know, when the flow of the water reverses, actually come up with a plan to still go upstream. And what you've said is correct, is to say that undeterred, with no change in course, voice is coming down, data is going through the roof in terms of revenue and traffic, but the margins are not, because essentially we are investing a considerable amount of money. I mean, there are not many companies that I know of in certainly the South African context who are investing close to $3 to $4 billion every year. And a lot of that is benefiting the OTTs. You know, they've got a great business model. You know, we just spend all the money and they just sell the content and so on. So there needs to be a paradigm shift. And that paradigm shift, in my mind, is that we need to see the digital services and new revenue as fundamentally the new business, not just a layer on top of voice. And to do that, I think your thinking needs to be you need a step change in your thinking. And the answers are not simple, but we need a step change. The good news is that MTN, as opposed to, you know, operator X or operator Y in Europe or the US, is in markets where there is still a very, very deep primary need. And secondly, that in the markets, we also have very, very youthful demographics, so people are still aspiring to buy things and need things. And thirdly, that we are a pretty, and I'm using the word dominant in a guided fashion here. I don't want the regulators to misconstrue that, but we are a very, very, you know, dominant operator. So if you put all of that together, I would summarize it this way. I think there's an opportunity for a company like MTN to become, you know, a Verizon and an Alibaba all in one, simply because of the unique situation that we find ourselves. I don't think that's translatable to everybody else. So, yes, I think we're at an inflection point, and the winners in the next 5 years are going to be those who, you know, are brave enough, not reckless, but have got a much clearer vision of how they can get ahead of the curve.
What about culture, though? I mean, telco culture is very different to Silicon Valley startup culture. How do you bridge that gap? Is a telco culturally able to build a meaningful internet business? Is it something you have to build completely separately to the telco mothership? How do you approach that issue?
Well, I think that's the million-dollar question. There's a lot of debate on that, which needs to be thought through very, very carefully. And I'd hate to put the new management team into a straitjacket. And I think there are many permutations, and there's quite a wide spectrum on that. But at core, your assertion is absolutely correct, is that, you know, the skill space that took MTN, you know, from 2000 to even, you know, 2015, which was a particular business construct that we all know, right, is not necessarily the skills base that's going to take you, you know, from where we are today for the next 10 years, because the evolution is very fast, it's becoming more digital, you need to improve your yields, because if you keep on investing the kind of capex we're investing, without creating new revenue streams that are of a decent margin, then in effect the return on investment would come down. So is it identified then what the solution is? But fundamentally, I'm saying content, financial services, et cetera, broadly called digital and new revenue, really needs to be a very, very important part of the business and needs to grow at such a pace that it outpaces the drop in voice revenue, which obviously was the contributor and the margin driver.
So do you build that from scratch? Do you start your own media business, your own video content streaming service, for example, or do you go out there and do you do like the US operators are doing? Do you do a Blockbuster acquisition?
Well, I suspect that if you try and do it all yourself, I think you'd lose focus, and I think you'd really, really struggle. I think you need to find a way of saying, what is the best construct of, you know, bringing in that content to a platform that's got 240 million subscribers? And there are many permutations of that as well. But even if, you know, whether it's JVs or certain strategic partners or even an acquisition for that matter, you still need a far more heightened skills base that can deal in that area, which we don't necessarily have. Mm-hmm. You know, we have people who are very much in the traditional mobile telecoms world, but, you know, content and how to exploit it, use it, add value to it, and distribute it is somewhat of a different game.
Mm. Do you have to? I mean, you've got a number of investments. I'm thinking of Snap in Iran, for example, which is an Uber competitor, mm-hmm. or an Uber-like service. We've seen NASPAS expand globally through making, in most cases, minority investments in companies like Tencent and leaving management on the ground to get on with the job of running the company, mm-hmm. with very little integration, actually. Mm-hmm. In the world that you see MTN going into, do you see the telco side of the business and the digital side of the business merging, becoming working very tightly together, or do you see the digital side of the business being quite independent of the telco?
I think there must be a way of working together. And working together does not necessarily mean, therefore, that it has to be a single integrated entity. It could be, right? But working together has to be, you know, there has to be that interface, because the hard reality is, if you take, you know, our e-commerce business in Iran and Snap in particular, which is the taxi ride, I think, you know, the issue is, you know, we need to leverage our base there of 47 million subscribers to make all those services. They've also got Z Foods. They've got a whole range of other services. They must have the base. But the young people that are sitting there in the Iran Internet group are a very, very different kind of breed of people in terms of skill, in terms of age, in terms of agility, and so on. So I think that has to be recognized. The real challenge is, what is the interface and how does that construct work? And I think that's really part of what you know, the guys that are taking the group to the next phase are going to have to grapple with.
Okay. I want to come back to home soil and talk a bit about South Africa's ICT policy white paper,
yes.
Just because it's very current at the moment, and there's a lot of concern, particularly amongst mobile operators, about some of the proposals that are concerned in there. So I wanted to get your view specifically on this policy paper, and I know that your South African CEO has expressed his views on the subject, but I wanted to get your view, with given your experience in this industry and what you've seen occurring in other markets, whether you think government is on the right track with this white paper, and just broadly what you think the opportunities and risks are associated with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, look, I think that, you know, if I can just start at a very sort of high level and make a general point, is that, and this is not unique to South Africa in any way, the biggest problem that we as a sector have is that even though there is said to be engagement between regulators and the operators, sometimes I do believe that we as the operators maybe don't convey some of the fundamental drivers as clearly as we should be conveying them. Because as I gave you merely as an example to say, if you're going to be spending $4 billion a year in CapEx, you want absolute clarity of the regulatory environment. You want to feel that you have, even if the rules are clear, that you can reasonably chart your own destiny within those rules, and not have extraneous factors, you know, unforeseen, and that you know, basically it continues, more importantly, to enable you to continue to invest. And some of the challenges here are that to say that a single company or entity will distribute spectrum and so on, it's all those issues of certainty and saying, you know, how is it run? Is it a fair, apportionment depending on who can actually invest and make the returns? And that in turn, ironically, has got an impact on just how rapidly the ICT sector, develops. So, because it's an ongoing discussion, and I'd hate to be seen to be negotiating it, you know, in a public forum over the media. All I can say is, we are engaged in government. We want to create the certainty, but in creating the certainty, we want to ensure that it's equitable to the investment that we're putting in, so that we can continue making the investment, and thirdly, that, you know, whatever construct is arrived at in the final analysis, you know, each operator needs to feel that they can reasonably determine their destiny. When I sit down with investors and say, yes, we're going to put another $4 billion. Or in the case of South Africa, 11 billion rands in the ground year on year, you know, this is the kind of return that we can expect. We can't say, well, we're not too sure when the spectrum is coming that allows us to get the high-value customers on LTE and so on and so on. We cannot be in a position where we can't answer such fundamental positions. So I hope there would be a meeting of the minds, but more importantly, I also wish that the matter is settled sooner rather than later, because we've had an extended uncertainty on spectrum, which affects the CapEx we put in and also affects the quality of service that the average person gets.
Mm. Just talking some bit more about the South African market, there's been a lot of corporate action and attempted corporate action over the last couple of years. Telkom most recently trying to buy Cell C, that deal with Blue Label now going ahead. I know that Telkom and MTN have engaged on a number of occasions in the past, most recently over attempt to share radio access infrastructure.
Yeah.
What is your view of the state of the South African market? You've got Vodacom, MTN, and Cell C, and then a very small telecom in the mobile market.
Mm.
There's constant talk about consolidation.
Yeah.
Do we have the right number of operators in South Africa? Do you think the Competition Authority should be more lenient when it comes to, so for example, Telkom having negotiations over radio networks with MTN? What's your view of the state of competition in this market? And I suppose that perennial question that's always on the back of mind of politicians and consumers, are data prices too high?
Yeah, well, you know, once again, you know, even though I think your question is very much, you know, pointed to South Africa, the response I'm going to give you actually applies to a whole number of markets that we're in, because there is similarity in the challenge. I think first and foremost, there is a little bit of a illusion that having many operators will benefit the regulator, benefit the consumer, and benefit the fiscus. That is not true. I'm not saying that you should have only one operator. All I'm just saying that depending on the size of the market, there is a point of diminishing returns. And what we're seeing in this market and what we're seeing in the Nigerian market as well, I suspect you've been following what has been happening there in the last few days, is that it's been demonstrated in a quite unfortunate way that once you have too many operators, you only have two or three, depending on the size, that just become meaningfully commercially sustainable, right? And you end up with the smaller players not being sustainable. But of course, what happens is it takes down tariffs in a very, very significant way for the large operators. They then start investing less. Government collects less taxes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So simple answer is absolutely there's plenty of room for consolidation, and I don't think the South African market would be unique in that respect. I think if there's consolidation, and of course the discussion we had just a bit earlier about certainty of the regulatory environment, I have no doubt that you would then see very heightened investment and there will be winners, you know, all around. So I think that's really our view.
Okay. Just in the context, you mentioned capital investment by the operators. I mean, the MTN is investing, I think, must be close to, if not a record amount in its network in South Africa at the moment. Vodacom is continuing to invest huge amounts of money, not quite at the MTN level, I think, in the last year, but quite close to it. And Cell C has made commitments as well. So given those levels of investment, that almost seems to suggest that the market is working because the operators are spending huge amounts of money.
Yeah, but huge is very relative.
Okay.
I'm saying that if there were consolidation in the market, if there was a much clearer roadmap and line of sight on the regulatory environment, and of course, you know, what we discussed earlier is that I do think, you know, there needs to be a paradigm shift. I think that you could see an even larger investment because then, you know, people would then end up with a higher return on investment than what we're seeing today. And the ROIs have been falling. A lot of MTN SA capex is somewhat catch-up capex, but that's also going to taper off unless there is a fundamental restructure of the industry. If that happens, then I think you'd clearly see much more into the future.
Okay, great. I know we are running quickly out of time, so I want to start to wrap up, Phuthuma.
No, that's fine.
I just want to ask you, your the new CEO starts on Monday, Rob Shooter. Quite familiar with this industry, of course. He was chief financial officer at Vodacom and has experience at Vodafone over the last few years. What advice, and I know you can't, you won't be able to tell us in public all the advice you're giving him, but just sort of at a headline level, what are you telling Rob Shooter he needs to watch out for?
Well, look, I think we've all got very different management styles as management. Therefore, you can't expect that the way that you pursued and managed the company, in my case, for for, you know, first the 10 years and then now for, you know, unforeseen for a critical, you know, 14 months, you can just replicate that to somebody else because we're all different. Having said that, I would say, you know, clearly this sector in this part of the world has got very, very wide stakeholders, which are always requiring of engagement, firstly. And secondly, as you and I discussed a bit earlier, I think there is quite a significant opportunity here given the unique position that we have, primarily because it is a market that's in development stage, or most of our markets in development stage. So it gives us an opportunity to take what is good out of the more developed markets in terms of practice and processes and so on, but it also means that we have to have quite an entrepreneurial eye in what you can do in Uganda is not necessarily what you may want to do in France. Mm. So I think it's stakeholders, but it's also basically exploiting a platform that's in a unique market. And of course, if I may say so, I think MTN itself is a very, very unique company. You know, we've got over, you know, 50, 60 nationalities, notwithstanding that we're in 22 countries from all over the world. So those ingredients are pretty important.
Good. Just lastly, you're going to continue as non-executive chairman of the MTN Group until the end of next year, end of 2018. Yeah. Are you going to follow your former chairman into politics at some point? Is that of any interest at all? What are your future plans after MTN?
Well, I'm part of a group that I started, you know, in 1994, which is called the Pembina Group, which is in a number of sectors or two sectors. So I'll continue to do that, and we're cut out for different roles. I don't believe I'm a politician in that respect. Not to say one doesn't have strong views on certain things, but. No, I'm going to continue to do where I think I can add the most amount of value
through that group then.
Through that vehicle and through many other initiatives, including things that I'm involved in, like the Mandela Children's Hospital and those kind of things, which I think are absolutely vital. Mm. But yes, we'll continue to engage all the people, including the politicians.
Okay,
thanks.
All the best, Phuthuma. Thank you for your time on this podcast.
Thank you.